In our look at the life of David, we've now moved from 1 Samuel into 2 Samuel. In chapter 1 of the book of 2 Samuel, Israel, as we read earlier, has reached a dreadful point in her history. The massed ranks of the Philistine army have won an overwhelming victory at Mount Gilboa. The battle has seen the slaughter of many, many Israelite soldiers, along with the wholesale retreat of the army, the rest of the army. And not even an organised retreat, but they simply fled from the battlefield. They have fled before the power of the Philistines, the overwhelming force. And the fear that that's generated is such that even all the local civilians living in the towns round about, the area that surrounds the battlefield, they've fled too. They've abandoned homes, they've abandoned farms, and they've done so in fear of their lives. The Philistines have won a great victory. They have taken not just success over the army, but they've taken more land for themselves. They've moved forward. And that disaster reaches its pinnacle, its climax, really, in the events on the top of Mount Gilboa, where King Saul and his sons are slain. The defeat of those leaders, of those heroes in Israel, has left everyone else without the heart to fight on. They lose hope at that moment. Even Prince Jonathan, one of the great men of the country, has been slaughtered. And as we read in 31, the surrounding Philistine troops just closed in upon Saul until he eventually, in fear of what they would do to him, took his own life, fell on his own sword, committed suicide. At this black moment in Israel's history, David is still far away. He's not with the troops fighting on Gilboa. He's in Ziklag, a town that's already under the control of the Philistines. David himself has just won a small victory. You may remember last time how the Amalekites had raided Ziklag and taken everything from there, including all the wives and children, and burned the place down. But David had pursued them. He'd defeated them. He'd recovered everything that had been taken, and then returned back to that town. But it's a place that isn't fit for returning heroes. It's been ravaged, it's been burned down by the Amalekites. This moment in Israel's history, even for David and his men, it's a sad, it's a bleak time for everyone. David, in 2 Samuel 1, doesn't yet know about the disaster that's befallen Israel itself. He doesn't yet know about Saul and Jonathan's death. He's only been back in Ziklag for 2 days at this moment. He hasn't heard any news from the battlefront. He's been caught up in his own fight. Remember, these are not days with radio or telephone or satellites. David will only know what's happened if somebody turns up and tells him, when a messenger comes. And as far as David is concerned, when we first break into 2 Samuel, he's still on the run. He's still having to live with the enemy. He still has this dreadful mess to tidy up in Ziklag before his men and his families can settle back down to some sort of normal life, albeit the life of those who are not able to live in their own country. And then into Ziklag comes a young man. This young man has a mournful look on his face. He's dusty from his journey. He's been travelling on a hard trip. But he's made himself look worse. He's got dust all over him, dust all over his head, dust over his face. And his clothes are torn. He wants everyone around him to notice. He is the bringer of solemn and of sad news. News that is coming to David. Now let's think for a moment about this man. How does he want to present himself, this young man, this young messenger who arrives in Ziklag? First of all, there's his physical appearance, which I've just mentioned. The Middle Eastern culture, the culture of those countries, is one which is much more able to express itself physically than our restrained and inhibited British one. When bewailing some distressing circumstances or mourning the death of a loved one, people will cry out loud, they will rip open their clothes, they will throw dust on their heads. In other words, they'll take part in the disaster that's befallen them. If you were to come across someone with their clothes torn apart, then you would assume that some terrible accident had just occurred. Even a simple fall from a bike can rip open a pair of trousers or whatever. And likewise, if you were to come across someone with dust in their hair and a face that was smeared with dirt, then you'd assume some terrible accident had just occurred. We don't get in that state just from walking around. Our feet, our shoes get messy, that's part of life. Maybe even our hands get messy if we do physical work. But unless we work in some sort of enclosed, dusty area, then for our head to be messed up and scruffy, something must have gone wrong, some accident must have occurred. Throughout the Bible, we find people who choose to bring these outward signs of disaster, trouble, accident, upon themselves as an indication of their sadness, of the distress that they feel inside. And there's nothing wrong in that. Strong emotions may need strong ways to express themselves. It isn't of itself play acting or pretending. We're physical creatures. What we experience and feel inside will come out of us, not just in our words, but by the look on our faces, by the tones of our voices, by the body language that we use, and by our actions. We do know this in other ways, don't we? An angry man will clench his fist or will kick a stone. A woman in love will gaze into her lover's eyes or stroke his hair. It's that outward expression of what we're feeling inside. This young man wants to show that he is someone who is feeling, who has got a message of something inside him of sadness, of disaster. He's someone who's just taken part in, or at least heard about, a dreadful disaster. His outward appearance, he wants to show that to people. And that's why he's ripped his clothes, that's why he's thrown dust on his head. Second thing I want you to see about this young man is the way he treats David. He goes straight up to David and he falls on the ground in front of him. He pays homage to him. He wants David to know, he wants everyone else to know, that special honour is due to David. He wants to show that he's a loyal servant. He knows his place. We find out later this man is carrying on him the jewellery of the king. David doesn't yet know that. But this young man has the crown from Saul's head and the band from his arm. And he's about to hand them over to David as recognition of David's new position. David is going to become the king. And this young man wants to show that he's not casual about that. If this is the future king in front of him, then he wants to bow the knee. He wants to offer service to him. It's interesting, isn't it? In our democratic, equality-driven culture, we've increasingly got rid of signs of honour that may be due to people. When we hear people using phrases like "my right honourable friend" in Parliament or "my lord" in court, then to us it's just a sort of quaint old-fashioned phrase. When we see tennis players bowing or curtsying to the royal box at Wimbledon, it's just an old-fashioned ritual that makes the day special. Those who were once given honour due to their position of leadership in society, you think of someone like a school teacher or a policeman, they no longer receive that treatment by others. Respect for a person's place, responsibility, their role in society has dwindled within our culture. But in the Bible, we don't find that. We find people giving honour where honour is due. Of course, the reason for that is not because of necessarily the person doing the job. It's that such honour care and respect is due firstly to God. He quite clearly, as our Creator, is due from us humble adoration, well-mannered obedience. We've no right to offer him anything else. We can't be casual about anything to do with the holy God, although we can be personal with him if we're believers, because he's our Father. But then we say, if God is due such respect, then so are those people that God has raised up in the world to act as kings, to act as judges, to hold positions of leadership. And we are to show them due respect to those positions, even if the person undertaking the job is not all he should be. This young man comes to David. He wants to show that he's someone who understands that. He goes down onto the ground in front of him. He pays homage to David. He gives honour to David. To look at the ground, to bow the knee in recognition of the status that God has given to David as the future king. Third thing I want you to see about this young man is how he presents himself. Think for a moment about the way he describes his presence in Ziklag. In verse 3, David asks him, "Where have you come from?" And this young man answers, "I have escaped from the Israelite camp." He is not just the bearer of bad news. He says to David, "I'm fortunate to be here at all. The disaster that I've come from, that you can see on me physically, that disaster might have completely overcome me. I could be lying dead on a battlefield at this moment, but I managed to escape." This man is presenting himself as more than just an ordinary messenger. This isn't just the postman. This isn't just the telegram boy delivering a message. He's had to take great personal risk. He's had to show great personal initiative in escaping from trouble to get to the town, to meet with David, to give him the message. He's had to plan out his escape from the trouble. In that moment of crisis when all the leaders of Israel were falling and all the officers were being killed and the men were going down around him, he had to see what was to be done and take decisive action. And he did. And he emphasizes that importance then when he explains why he's come to David. Secretly on his person he carries the crown and the band of Israel, the kingly signs that Saul has been wearing just up to the moment of his death. This is a mission of vital importance. That's the impression this young man wants to give. He's rescued the crown jewels from the enemy. He's brought them to the only man who can rightfully wear them now. Probably all of us know what it is to feel ourselves to be on some sort of special task, or to have at least a special message. You've got some good news to pass on. You've just heard that the house you want to buy is yours. The doctor has just confirmed that you're pregnant. And you're desperate to pass it on to someone else, to tell them. It's special news. It's not just the ordinary, everyday stuff of life, but something that will change life. There's an excitement about it. It's in your voice. There's a sort of breathlessness when you arrive and there's somebody there you're going to give this news to. You're waiting for the other person to stop talking. You're waiting for that moment when you can blurt out the exciting message you've got without interruption. And you're waiting to see the reaction on their face. It's going to change everything. It's your moment as the important messenger. That's this man. He wants to be seen as someone important. He arrives in Ziklag not just as an ordinary messenger, but as someone who has escaped from disaster to bring vital news, to carry this special treasure, the crown jewels, to the next king of Israel. And then fourthly, I want you to see how this young man presents himself as a faithful warrior and servant of the king. There he was on Mount Gilboa, the battle raging around him, playing his part in it, in the fight with the Philistines, but fighting for Israel. He says in verse 6 to David, David says to him first in verse 5, "How do you know that Saul and his son Jonathan are dead?" And in reply, this man says, "I happen to be on Mount Gilboa." This is not a man, in other words, of any particular status in the Israelite army. He didn't have to be near to Saul. He wasn't one of Saul's generals who were stood there with him. He wasn't one of his personal bodyguards who was protecting him. He just happened to be there as the battle turned this way and that. But then Saul, on the spur of the moment, singled him out for a special task. And this man is pleased to report that he saw it through. He knows that he's a foreigner. He told Saul, "I'm an Amalekite." But that didn't matter. Saul needed someone. He needed someone to help him die before the Philistines came and put him through a far worse death. And so he called upon this young foreign mercenary to run him through with his sword. And this young man was absolutely sure he was doing the right thing, as he confidently says to David later on. He says in verse 10, "So I stood over him and killed him, because I knew that after he had fallen, he could not survive." This man is putting himself forward as a wise and a good and a loyal soldier. He's had to make a difficult judgment, but he knew the right thing to do, and he did it. And of course, having helped Saul to die, then he knew what his next duty must be: to get the crown, to take the armband, to make sure that they get to the next king, to get them to David as quickly as possible. That's what a loyal soldier, that's what a faithful servant should do. There are times in life when we want to impress somebody, isn't there, with our loyalty, with our faithfulness. So we do something that we're sure will please them, and then we make sure that they know about it. For some people, it's pleasing the teacher when they're in school, letting the teacher know they finished their homework last night by 5:30. That's how dutiful they are, getting the right thing done at the right time. They're looking for the pat on the head. They're looking for the recognition of their good work, their faithfulness, their loyalty. That's this man. He comes to Ziklag to present himself as the good soldier who's tried to do what's right. If you'd been with David that day, if you'd seen this man come in, that's what you'd have seen. You'd have seen him, his physical appearance, a man who's been caught up in some terrible disaster. You'd have seen the honour and the respect that he gives to David, recognising his status and standing in Israel. You'd have seen this man present himself as an important messenger with something highly significant to say. And you'd have heard him present himself as a faithful and loyal soldier of the kingdom. And with all of that, this young man must have had such high hopes of a good reaction from David. Surely David is just going to be delighted that he's come to him and that he's given him this news. David's going to be so pleased, isn't he, that his enemy Saul is dead. The man who's pursued him in the wilderness, the man who's driven him from his home, the man who's caused him so much trouble and tried to kill him. He's going to be delighted that this soldier has arrived to say that Saul is dead. Long live the new king. And David's going to want to reward him, isn't he? Things are not what they seem. People are not what they seem. This man was not what he seemed. We as the story readers already know that. We read earlier on from chapter 31, before we came into chapter 1. We read about Saul committing suicide. And it wasn't. We know it wasn't to an Amalekite that he turned for help. He turned to his Jewish armour bearer. And the armour bearer refused to strike the king. And in fact, when he saw the king had killed himself, He then committed suicide himself. We know the truth, and we know this young man is simply lying about being the one who struck Saul down. This man is a liar, he is a cheat, he is a con man who wants to use the situation for his own benefit. This man went to David simply to impress him. And all that we've talked about, all of those things he did, the outward appearance and the homage he paid and the message he brought and the loyalty of this soldier, all of them were just acts to ingratiate himself into David's good books. He wanted a place in the new king's court. He wanted a place in the new political landscape that was opening up. He wanted the favour of the king. He was a con man. I don't know how easily David saw through this man. Obviously, he wouldn't have started with a very positive attitude towards him anyway, given it was the Amalekites who had burned down the town whose ruins he was actually sat in at the moment. Possibly there is a disbelieving tone in his question of verse 5. How do you know that Saul and Jonathan are dead? Maybe David's already identified him as a non-Israelite, and he's wondering whether the ripped clothes and the dust on his head are real at all. I wonder if David might have started slightly when the man said to him, "I'm an Amalekite." Would Saul really have wanted an Amalekite to kill him in preference to the Philistines? This is one of the strange ironies in this story, isn't it? Even in his death, Saul is still haunted by his failure to obey God. It was the Amalekites that Saul should have wiped out for their criminal actions. And Saul failed. And now there's another one of that tribe still causing Saul trouble, even after he's dead. And then, of course, as David listened to the story, there's the whole question of the actual events. This man says that he's on the mount, and that he's there near enough to Saul to talk to him and then to strike him down. And it's just at the moment, he says, when everything is coming to a crisis. And there was Saul, in verse 6, leaning on his spear, with the chariots and riders almost upon him. He says the Philistines were so close, it was the crisis moment. And nonetheless, I managed to talk to him, kill him, take his armband off his arm, take his crown from his head, hide them, and get away without being killed by the Philistines. And then I managed to travel through all the enemy lines, and then I managed to get to Ziklag to give you this message. There are parts of the story which just don't ring true. And I wonder if David sensed those. But for David, there is one factor in this whole case which simply decides it for him. David has one simple principle. Nobody has the right to strike down the king of Israel. They don't have that right, not because Saul was a wonderful man and nobody should ever have harmed him. They don't have that right because he is the Lord's anointed king. And it is for the Lord himself to decide when and where he should die. That is what held David back from revenge, isn't it, on previous occasions. When he was in the desert, when he was in the cave, and he could have murdered Saul very easily. He was right behind him, he could have cut his throat, he was there in the camp with Abishai. And Abishai says, "Let me put a spear through him." But David refused. He refused himself to kill Saul. He refused his men, Abishai, to kill him. And so he will not accept now this man coming to him and saying, "I've killed him." And certainly not an Amalekite, a tribe which has already been condemned to death by God for its criminality. And so David just acts on the moment decisively. This young man has condemned himself to death. By striking God's king, this man has meant that he now deserves to die. His own words have condemned him. And David calls for one of his swordsmen to strike him down. This story, first part of chapter 1, is the story of the death of a con man. A con man who brought about his own death, who brought it onto his own head, because he was trying to exploit a situation for his own benefit. What does a passage like this say to us? Well, if nothing else, it reminds us that there are always people out there who are willing to exploit trouble for their own benefit. Maybe we find it hard to believe, but it is simply true. Do you remember Joe Moore? Do you remember Joe Moore and her infamous memo that she wrote on the 11th of September 2001? Miss Moore was working as an advisor in the government, our government, and she wrote at 2:55 in the afternoon a memo. At that moment, millions of people around the world were transfixed, watching their television sets as the Twin Towers in New York collapsed to the ground and people were throwing themselves to their deaths. People were transfixed by the image of an aircraft just flying straight into the side. And as that aircraft crashed into the towers, Miss Moore was writing her memo. She wrote, "It is now a very good day to get out anything we want to bury." In other words, she was saying, let's release any bad government news now, because no one will hear about it, because there's other bad news that will cover it up. She had a cynical, a ruthless attitude to personal gain. Other people are dying, but I can ride on the back of it for my benefit, for my boss's benefit. That was Joe Moore. That was this young Amalekite. Saul and Jonathan dead? Oh well, life goes on. Let's see what I can gain out of it. I'll grab the crown and the armband. I'll head off to see David. I'll make up some cock and bull story on the way. He'll be so grateful to me. We come across this attitude in all sorts of ways. Every so often, you'll hear about somebody going round knocking on doors, collecting for a good cause. They'll tell people that they're from a charity for the homeless, or they're from a charity for Africa's starving children, or whatever. We've had children from the school where I work doing just that. They'll go around knocking on the doors, collecting for some good cause. And of course, what they're collecting for is themselves. The fact that they're taking money for themselves on the back of some genuine need doesn't matter to them. There's nothing like exploiting other people's troubles for your own benefit. We find the more overt exploitation of other people's troubles off-putting, don't we? Joe Moore's act seems horribly repulsive. If we've watched the collapse of the Twin Towers, if we think about those people burning to death, or being crushed, or jumping from the windows. But the underlying careless and cold-hearted attitude towards the suffering of others is very common in the human race. I can still remember jokes from my school days that were made about Airy Neave and Louis Mountbatten. Do you remember those two men, in separate instance, being blown to pieces by the IRA? And the next day, there were jokes passing around about those deaths. And isn't it the case, you think of a totally different example, that when someone dies in a family and there's mourning and there's black ties at the funeral, and very soon afterwards there's the arguments about the will and who gets the money and how much they get and whether it's fair. Human beings can easily turn someone else's suffering into an occasion for their own benefit. It's that human capacity to care nothing for other people's suffering that underlies so much wickedness. It's how a country like Cambodia can be turned to become a place of non-stop murder, as it did in the 1970s, earning the name Killing Fields. It's the same attitude that means that in this country we can continue to kill babies in the womb by abortion, even after there's a broadcast on television of images showing how alive an unborn baby actually is, just a few weeks after conception. Cynicism, cruelty, carelessness, indifference, there are all sorts of ways in which we detach ourselves from the sufferings of others, including the way which has been used time after time, which is simply to deny that this other person is a human at all. They don't count as much as me. Their life isn't as valuable as mine. So if I can benefit from their trouble, then that's fine. For a Christian, the biggest and the most striking example of humanity's attitude is seen at the cross of Calvary. There you have the most innocent man who ever lived, and he's nailed up in extreme suffering. He's become so weak that he can barely walk, and he certainly couldn't carry his own cross. The beatings and the whippings have physically destroyed him. His body is falling apart, his face is a mess. On the cross, in the heat, amongst the flies, each movement agony, he hangs to die. Pain shooting through his body as his systems collapse. This perfect and good man tortured to death in public. And what do the nice people, and what do the religious people of Judea think about it? And what do the Roman soldiers think about it, the proud representatives of the greatest civilization on the earth? We read that those who passed by hurled insults at him, shaking their heads and saying, "You who are going to destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself." And what about the priests and leaders? "He saved others, but he can't save himself." And meanwhile, the Roman soldiers are busy gambling at the foot of the cross for his clothes. For many people, the death of Jesus was just another daily event. They were just passing by on their way to somewhere else. But they didn't mind using his suffering as a moment to get a few things off their chest. For the religious leaders, well, his suffering was just an opportunity to get their own back, to crack a few jokes at his expense, to get their revenge for the fact that he won so many debates with them. For the Roman soldiers, his suffering is just the opportunity to pick up a new robe. These people aren't different from us. There is not something uniquely evil about them. We too would be the same. This attitude, it has its seeds within each one of us. It begins with pride, that belief that I matter more than you do. It develops in selfishness, that willingness to take what I need, no matter how it affects others. It pushes itself out through our words, gossipy words, behind someone's back, or cutting words to their face. But words, however they're said, which say, "You don't matter. I can talk about you. I can talk to you as I want." Those are the seeds, the attitudes and the words that then lead to the action. These things growing in the heart can produce that same cold-hearted exploitation of others in their suffering. We aren't so different from the Amalekite con man. Just put us in the right circumstances and we would do the same. We aren't so different from the people who walked by Jesus' cross. What is your natural reaction to the suffering of others? Do you start with, "What can I do for them?" Or do you start with, "What does this mean for me?" Do you remember how Jesus said, "Love your neighbour as yourself," and then explained it with the story of the Good Samaritan? a story about the rescue of a troubled and needy man by someone who should have been his natural enemy. It is the very opposite of what we're talking about. This Amalekite was judged for his sin. The first century Jews were judged for their sin against Jesus. And we too will be judged. For every decision we take, every word we speak, which ignores or exploits the suffering of others. It will end with our death, whether in this world or in the future, a second death that the Bible speaks of, an eternal death. But this morning, we can thank God for the death of that cross that we've talked about. Because the man who was mocked, the man who was exploited, the man who died in agony is also our hope when we think about this sin. Because in his death there is life. In his death there is forgiveness for this sin, as there is for all sins. What we are by nature, what we see in this passage and within our own hearts, can be forgiven. What we are by nature can be changed. And it is through that cross, through that suffering, through that sacrifice that Jesus made, misunderstood, ignored, exploited by those around him, but a death of infinite value. A death in the place of others to save them from death. If you will put your faith in Jesus Christ, his death can be of saving value to you. You're not exploiting him by doing that. It is a gift that he offers to you, the gift of life through his death on the cross. God sent his son to die on that cross, to forgive the sin that you have committed, the sin that has ruined our race, the sins we've been talking about. God sent his son to give new life to those who are saved in this way. You need that forgiveness. Do you have that forgiveness? No matter how badly you've treated others, no matter what it is that you have done, he can save. He is the only one who can save. And that same cross will then teach you how to treat others as you should. You see, once we recognise the purpose, the value of Jesus' death upon the cross, then by the power of the Holy Spirit, the Spirit of God, that same cross must reverse all these natural human attitudes we've talked about. The cross tells us not to exploit people's suffering, but rather to be ready to suffer ourselves for other people. The cross reverses the attitude we see in this Amalekite man. Jesus' attitude was that he was prepared to give up everything for the sake of his Father in heaven and the people whom he loved. He was willing to suffer for others, to give his life for others. And then he called his people, his disciples, he called Christians to do the same. He said to them, take up your cross. He called for Christians to do as he has done. He called for Christians to serve others. Even if it involves great personal cost, even if it eats up our lives, even if it causes our deaths. The cross preaches to us the opposite of the attitude we meet in this Amalekite con man. There are two tragic deaths in 2 Samuel chapter 1. There is the death of this man, and there is the death of King Saul. Both men pursued a life for themselves. Both men used situations for themselves. and both men came to a meaningless and hopeless end. But the death of Jesus Christ was no tragedy. It was the greatest moment in history. And a Christian who follows his master will be a part of that victory, even in suffering, even in death. It is a death that brings life.